and you'll be able to get it actually online. I'll show you where to get it. So this is the help review session for test number 4 in Chem 110, and it'll be covering just chapters 6 and 7 and a microscopic amount of 8. And so let's just get right on it. So I'm going to turn now to the overheads, and that would be number, and I don't see 6. Let me see if I can find 6 here. Dun, 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 dun. Do, 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 do. Okay, we're now looking at overhead number chapter number 6. Overheads, I'm going to plug this in. We're going to turn it on. And you guys have driven me to drink, so I'm having a little pop. Go figure. And let's see here. Boom. And is it going to come on or not? And is it going to come down? There we go. Chapter number 6, solutions, ladies and gentlemen. So this is December 3, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the Chemistry Amphitheater, and it's a review of chapter 6 and 7 and a little microscopic amount of 8 for the test coming up on Wednesday afternoon after we check out from lab. And so that, I'm thinking about 4 o'clock-ish, and you can have from 4 o'clock till 4:15 to do the test. And, huh? Did I say from 4 to 4:15? Oh, I'm sorry. I meant 4 to 4:10. At any rate, so you'll be able to have as much time as you need to do this. Let's take a look at what's going on. Again, now, this section is, I'm just going to go this by slide, actually. Let me just get out of this. You can expect to have this is slide number 1, chapter 6. You can expect to have definitions either by filling it out or matching. And this is a set. Yes?
Didn't you say it was scantron?
Yes, but I've discovered I'm not going to be able to have time to write the thing. But nevertheless, even if I do have time to write it, you're still going to have questions about definitions. I mean, I can do that scantron as well as anybody. So, but yeah, it's probably going to be a little bit of fill-in. And there's calculations. I really need to see you do the calculations on some of this. So it's probably not going to be as much scantron as I would like it to be. So you can see the properties of solutions and the definitions here. This is overhead number 2, some very simple examples. Overhead number 3 is, for example, the general properties of solutions, where they're transparent, electrolytes will form, will carry electricity, non-electrolytes don't dissociate and don't conduct electricity, volumes are not additive. Colloids, definition of colloids, they're larger particles, they may appear identical, but they have the Tyndall effect. So this is overhead number 4. Is it 4 or 5? It's actually 1, 2, 3, from the page, from the, I'm not counting the splash page, the content page, it's actually number 5, the Tyndall effect. Probably overhead number 6, actually, but fine, I'll start calling it overhead number 6. The Tyndall effect is where, when you shine a light through something that's not a solution, but it's actually a colloid suspension, that is, it's got very fine particles that are divided, you get that gray look. You get this thing. Oh, my goodness. You get that that. So that one's a colloid suspension, and that's not. That's a true solution. There's no haze there. So compare and contrast a regular solution with a colloid solution, and it talks about the Tyndall effect. Yes, indeed. Okay, so I am, in fact, recording. All right, definition of what solubility is, how much a particular solvent dissolves, and then these are the factors. You will need to know those. Okay, need to know those. Be able to tell me about them. And here's some, again, some additional definitions. You're going to need to tell me these definitions. How do you get a supersaturated solution, by the way, ladies and gentlemen? How do you do that? You heat it till it gets more in there, and then you allow it to cool, and it stays in solution even though it's not supposed to at that temperature, at least for a while. If it doesn't precipitate at that new cooler temperature, the solution will be supersaturated because, remember, solubility is temperature-based. Temperature, temperature, temperature. So they always have to tell you what temperature this is at. Saturated solution. Can you tell me why a saturated solution that contains both the solution and the solid, why that illustrates a dynamic equilibrium? Well, the amount of the solids dissolving is equal and opposite to in rate to the amount of solution that's reforming a solid. So the amount of dissolving equals the amount of precipitation. And so you have that dynamic equilibrium. That's overhead number 9. Overhead number 10. What in the world is Henry's Law, ladies and gentlemen? Henry's. This is what's going to be on the test. You'll need to define Henry's Law. Okay, and that is solubility is directly related, proportional to the pressure. And gases are most soluble at what? Low temperatures. Please don't forget that. Gases are soluble. They're the opposite of what you think. Gases are soluble at low temperatures, not high temperatures like liquids and solids. They're the opposite of what you might expect. Concentration based on mass, that's pretty easy. Not much here. Concentration, you need to know the definition of it, but otherwise there's not much there. Can you do the weight volume percent composition equations? Can you do that? You remember the equation I asked you to write down? My version of this was what? It was, for example, grams of solute divided by grams of solution is equal to what? X percent over what? 100. And using that, gram-gram means you're dealing with weight-weight. What if I had gram mil, what would that be? Yeah, weight volume, ML. So that's weight volume, WV, weight volume, WV. Very common. You can expect to have questions over it. I guarantee it. Bring your calculator. Bring your awakeness. Go to sleep before you get this test. I had a student who went through we just sat down and went through a biochemistry test for them, especially the multiple choice, and we sit down and we look at the first answer, first question. And he goes, oh no. I mean, he looked at it and it's clear what the obvious first answer should have been on that first question, what the answer should have been. And he completely blew it on the multiple choice, and he goes, I have no idea why I put the answer down I did. I said, what time did you go to bed? How many hours of sleep did you get before you took the test? He said, well, I stayed up all night for the test. Well, of course, you were groggy to the point of being incoherent. That's why you put that down. Go to bed! You'll actually get more points going to bed than struggling to figure out how to stay up. Okay, calculate weight percent. I'm going to go to weight volume again. I use my calculation, not what they say here. Of course, weight means you don't use gram solute and mil solution. You use gram solvent and gram solution. That's really very simple. X over 100%. Parts per million, parts per thousand. I'm not going to ask any questions over parts per million and parts per thousand. Although it's an important statistical version. It really is very simple. Parts per thousand, parts per million are trivial. It's now parts per billion and parts per trillion is what chemists can get to. Any rate. Okay. Concentration solutions, moles and equivalents. This is overhead number 17. This is just an introduction to moles and equivalents. Calculations of molarity here. You need to know the defining thing. This is overhead number 17, number 18. You definitely need to know all that, how to do that. Molarity is equal moles divided by liters. Okay. And then you have the practice for number 19 is practice. Practice is number 20. Nothing new there. Dilution. Now, dilution, of course, dilution is, what equation is dilution? M1 V1 equals what? M2 V2. And so you're going to have one of those four variables is unknown, and you have to figure out which is which. That's the tricky part on these dilution problems. It's figuring out which one is which. Okay, knowing any three terms permits calculation of the fourth. And so your job is to figure out what the fourth one is you don't know. So, again, you can figure out the amount of molarity after dilution, M1, V1, M2, V2, and M1 and M2 are the molarity. All right, representation of concentrations of ions in solution. Of course, ions in solution, we, of course, have moles per liter, which is what? Molarity. Or equivalents per liter, which is known as EQ and L, which is N or normality, and the emphasis is on the charge, the total amount of charge. How much charge is there? You want to balance the charges. Comparison of molarity and equivalence. Equivalent, of course, we defined as one mole of any charge. One mole of a positive ion, one mole of a negative ion. One mole, one mole, one mole. An equivalent can be some mass of the ion divided by the number of charges. So they defined it sort of like grams per equivalent. I sort of did something else, but that's okay. Read in your textbook, ladies and gentlemen. These questions are not going to be that difficult, but I will expect you to have some handle on it. For example, if I tell you you have one mole of phosphate, which has got a negative 3, how many equivalents of phosphate do we have? Why do I have 3 equivalents of phosphate? Where did that come from? If I had one mole of phosphate, I have 3 equivalents. Where'd that come from? The charge. What's the charge on phosphate? It's a what? 3 negative. Every mole of a charge is one equivalent. Every mole of a charge is one equivalent. Every mole of a charge is one equivalent. Now, what did I just say 3 times? One mole of a charge is an equivalent. So if I have one mole of phosphate, how many moles of charge do I have? 3, which means I have 3 equivalents. If I have one mole of sodium, how many moles of charge do I have? 1, which I have 1 equivalent. And sulfate and all that kind of thing. Well, you can figure that out. Okay, and so calculating ion concentration. This is calculate the equivalents per liter. Did I tell you to skip that? Yeah. I did?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
No, are you really sure?
Yeah.
Really, really sure with, you know, cross your heart and, what is it? Hope to die? I don't, I've stopped saying that. At 58, it's altogether too close. Cross your heart and hope to, oh no, never mind. I'll just cross my heart. Okay. So we skipped this, is that correct? And this is not doing anything, because I don't have it plugged in. That is a reason for that. All right, now, concentration-dependent properties. These are called colligative properties, ladies and gentlemen. Colligative, you need to know the definitions. What are the 4 colligative properties? Vapor pressure what? Boiling point what? Freezing point? Depression and osmotic pressure. So this has very real practical applications to health. I can tell you when you're dehydrated, when you don't have enough water, this colligative property in terms of how your cells behave and stuff. That really gets important. You die from dehydration. There's just no doubt about it. Okay. Now, you don't necessarily, Raoul's law, in molecular terms, Raoul's law, the vapor pressure of a liquid. Okay, vapor pressure of a results in the escape of the solvent from liquid to gas phase. What does that do? Presence of molecules, soluble molecules, hinders the escape, which means it has less vapor pressure. Okay? You can think of it as this liquid trying to evaporate. And you've seen this. Ooh, that's an old gesture, isn't it? What does this mean? What? Raise the roof? Check your deodorant? No. I don't know. Raise the roof. I have no idea. At any rate, I'm so old. But life is good. Isn't it? Yes, it is. Well, not worry about it. I'm just looking at you. What are you looking at me for? Go away. Anyway, I'll go away so I don't make you feel uncomfortable. Anyway, I can tell you, if you ever teach kids, don't, unlike me, don't be trapped in the front. If you have a kid that's acting up, the best way to do this, if you have to talk, is simply continue to talk and then move to the back of the room and just stand right there. Oh, that makes them so uncomfortable. Okay. Oh, man. Not you, of course, because you're an outstanding student. But others who are acting up, stuff like physical presence. Oh, never mind. You want to do this? Okay. So, anyway, so you got your without any solute molecules that without any solute, the vapor can clearly push as hard as it can against the atmosphere. That's called the vapor pressure. You put an interfering material in it, a solute, salt. Salt and like glue, sugar or something like that, and then they try to push, they can't push as hard because there's glucose and stuff in front of them, between them and the atmosphere, and they can't push as hard, so their vapor pressure lowers. Right, their vapor pressure lowers, and they can't evaporate as quickly, and it takes a higher temperature before they boil. So that is the presence of solute molecules hinders the escape, lowering the vapor pressure. If there's anything you need to know this. Okay? Know that. And this is Raoul's law. Well, we're not going to do too much of Raoul's law, except it just simply says that the vapor pressure decreases in proportion to concentration of solute. Again, this is exactly what I just said on the last slide. This is overhead number 30. Solute molecules serve as a barrier. Freezing point depression, boiling point elevation. Now, there is an important diagram. I think I did this a little bit. See if I can remember how I did this. I had the diagram or figure was a chart. So you had a vertical line and a horizontal line. Okay. And on the vertical line was pressure. And then in parentheses underneath the pressure, I put vapor pressure. And on the horizontal line, the x-axis, I put T, or temperature. Okay? And across the top, a horizontal line near the top of the vertical line, I'm going to put, see if I can do that. There we go. I'm going to put a nice horizontal line. I'm going to do that, call that atmospheric pressure. Atmospheric pressure. Have you guys ever seen that before? All right, did that before, right? Yeah. And if you hold it up tighter, you can actually get tighter. Like that. And so here you can get longer. Anyway, I amuse easily. Yes, indeed. Okay, so here's the temperature. What you find here, for example, for the vapor pressure, like for water, as the temperature rises, the vapor pressure of water rises as well. When it meets the atmospheric pressure, what's happening? This is pure water. Yeah.
pure water. And at that point, that's that boiling thing. That boiling thing that you know so well. Where the bubbles in that water contain nothing but what?
Water vapor.
Water vapor. There's no oxygen, there's no hydrogen, there's no carbon dioxide. It's little bubbles of steam in there. You stuck your head in there, first you have a cooked head, and you wouldn't be able to breathe anyway. You'd suffocate because it all was water vapor. You'd suffocate almost immediately. I mean, you could still breathe, but you'd be breathing not oxygen. So what happens then, I'm going to extend this a little longer. If you make an impure material, if you add a solvent, if you add some sort of like sugar or salt or whatever, if you have, you add a solute, let's just say salt and water. Now the difference is not that big. Okay, the difference is, I'm exaggerating just like this. So what temperature is this under normal circumstances for pure water? If I draw this down here to the temperature, what is that temperature right here? 100 degrees Celsius, that's correct. Okay, but if I put pure water, if I add some stuff in there, I lower the vapor pressure, which means the angle of that increase is not as great as when it's pure water, and so it just takes more and more temperature. Finally, we get it to where it begins to boil again. That's boiling. That's still boiling, but it's at salty water, and so the temperature is going to be a little higher. Now, it's not 150 degrees like this looks like. It's probably 101, maybe 102 degrees, but you get the idea that adding a material to a pure water lowers the boiling point, and so it takes a higher temperature before it reaches the atmospheric pressure and begins to boil. Okay? That's what happens. All right. So that's boiling point. Now, what about freezing point depression? I wonder, do you think we could probably do this same chart for freezing point depression? Let's try that, shall we? Let's make the chart upside down because we're going to go a little differently here. What's the pressure? Well, we'll just have to see. We're just going to have to see. We're going to do it like this. So there's a top horizontal line, and then there's a vertical line downward from that. It looks like the quadrant number. What quadrant number is this on a graph? Is that quadrant 3, only it's just the quadrant. And then the top line is temperature, of course. And the horizontal line is... freezing point. I'm trying to do this on the fly, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do this or not. See, how do I want to do this? Because there's not boiling, it just changes from solid to a liquid. Liquid to solid. And see, I'm guessing here, so just hold on. So I guess this is freezing. Okay. And maybe I don't want temperature there. Because there's no... Maybe I want molality there. Maybe I want molality. So if I have... If I have 0 degrees Celsius here, that's where things freeze. Is that right? Yeah. This, I don't think I'm going to make this. I don't like this, where this is going. We're just going to put a pause button on this idea and just drop it, okay? Just because it doesn't work for freezing point depression quite as nicely as it does for vapor pressure elevation, and I'll have to figure out how that works. Maybe I'll show you later. Probably not. We don't have enough time. Let's not worry about it. The idea here about freezing point depression is the fact the more stuff you have in the water, the more it interferes making the crystal. Okay? The more stuff you have suspended. So dirty water freezes at a lower temperature than pure water does. Because as it tries to make that solid and hold hands with its water neighbor to make a water crystal, it can't because, bing, there's a bunch of dirt right there. You know, So the water can't see each other, so you have to get it colder before the ice forms. And that's called freezing point depression. Does that make sense? So the more stuff dissolved, the lower the melting point.
Okay. Lower. Up. Freezing point depression. Okay, it's the actual number of what? Particles. Not the composition, but the total number of particles. All right. Why would sodium chloride lower the freezing point twice as much as glucose? Why is that?
What's going on there? Well, you have, for example, let's have glucose. All right, we have NaCl, and we have calcium chloride, which is a Cl2. And so what we're going to do here is we're going to have one mole of each. One mole. I'm writing out glucose, calcium chloride, sodium chloride, and calcium chloride in a little table. Next to it, I'm writing one mole. And then I'm going to put in, draw a line above that line, write in dissolved. D-O-S-S-O-V-L-E-D, dissolved. Now, if I take one mole of glucose and I dissolve it in water, how many particles do I get out of it? One mole. Because that glucose does not dissociate. If I take NaCl, one mole of it, and I dissolve it in water, how many particles do I get out of it? 2 moles. What are the 2 moles I'm getting out of this? 1 mole of NaCl, Na+, and 1 mole of Cl-. So there are 2 moles. So when I compare glucose to sodium chloride, if I put this in a liter of water, a mole of glucose, and another liter of water, a mole of sodium chloride, which one is going to take, will have the greatest freezing point depression? Which one will it take to freeze the hardest? In other words, which one will have a lower temperature?
Sodium chloride,
because why? It's got 2 moles of particles in there compared to the glucose is 1. What about calcium chloride? How many particles do I have in? I put 1 mole in here, but how many particles do I get? 3 moles. Is that right? I get a calcium and 2 chloride ions. Of these 3, if I put 1 mole of glucose, 1 mole of sodium chloride, 1 mole of calcium chloride, which one will lower the freezing point the greatest in that solution? Calcium chloride. If the glucose dissociated, it would do the same thing, but glucose doesn't dissociate. So that's freezing point depression. It's the total number of particles. All right. Boiling point elevation. We're not going to do any calculations with it. But again, the idea is the more particles in there, the higher the temperature it'll be before it begins to boil. And molality, of course, molality. Did I skip that? All right, fine. Osmotic pressure. Well, I don't think we skipped that in terms of the concepts involved. This is overhead number 35. This is where you have solute molecules cannot cross these semipermeable membranes. The semipermeable membrane allow the solvent but not the solute to diffuse from one side to the other. That creates this osmosis or the osmotic pressure. And the solvent always moves to do what? Moves to dilute. Those water, the solvent, moves to dilute to try to create 2 solutions that are equally equal concentration. If you want to stop that movement, you have to apply pressure. The pressure necessary to stop the movement is called, not surprisingly, osmotic pressure. You need to know that. You do not need to know the calculation here. Is that correct? I think I said skip on this one. Is that right? Okay. Did I say skip on calculating osmolarity?
Yes.
Did I say skip on calculating osmotic pressure? Did I say skip on tonicity in the cell?
No.
This is what keeps
I just had a sandwich today, and I had some of my wife's famous, I had a sandwich yesterday, chicken salad spread. She takes baked chicken and adds almonds and some other stuff. It's very nice spread to use on sandwiches, but always I put lettuce on them. Now, when I get lettuce from the refrigerator, it's nice, nicely crisp, right? Because you want this limp lettuce. Is there nothing worse than limp lettuce? What?
Go eat
at
the calf.
Go eat at the calf if I like limp lettuce. Wow. Okay, he's not bitter. No, it's tough to feed a lot of people. Okay, it takes a particular skill set, and many times it doesn't work. Especially with something you have to have a different variety of foods. Okay, if you're just Taco Bell and you're making four different kinds of burritos, it's easy to make them fresh and hot and all the same way. I mean, look at Chipotle. Would you like to eat at Chipotle 3 days, 3 meals a day for a month? By the end of the month, you'd be pretty much what? Sick of it. Okay. So I know you're sick of the cafeteria, but nevertheless, it's the variety that the cafeteria provides, not necessarily. There's not every dish is a hit. Okay, tenacity of the cell. This, of course, comes from the fact that you crisped it up. And can you tell me the crenation, hemolysis, and isotonic? Why does something shrink in solution? Why would it shrink? Concentration outside or concentration inside is greater? Outside. And so water from the material moves into the outside, and therefore the cell shrinks. What about hemolysis or hypotonic cell? The concentration, is it greater on the inside or the outside? It's greater on the inside, and water moves into the inside to try to dilute it, and it blows the cell up. And isotonic means same on both sides. Okay, you see the cucumber there? That's hypertonic brine due to osmosis. It shrank. Water is a solvent. It's a universal solvent. Excellent solvent for polar molecules, most abundant liquid on the earth. Thank goodness we live on a planet of water. Truly. There's a book out called Rare Earth, and it describes how completely unlikely there will be in the universe to find a planet just like this. We're not talking just in our galaxy. They're talking about in the universe. There are entire galaxies. You'll not find a planet like this. Okay. I'm not going to ask you questions about the electrolytes in body fluids. Okay? I'm just not. It's just detailed. The idea of active transport is that you have to use energy to move the sodium potassiums around. So there is a transport process that uses energy. You sort of need to know that. Okay, so overhead number 46, 47, and 48, don't worry about. I'm not going to ask questions about it. Okay, last three. And four of the last five, I'm not going to ask anything. But the definition of active transport, I want you to be aware of it and be ready to answer questions about it. Okay, that's overhead number six. We have to go on and do number what? Seven. And that's, okay, we're going to do it quickly, and I apologize. Thermodynamics, you need to know the definition of thermodynamics. The basic concepts of kinetic molecular theory, you need to be able to talk to me about why chemical reactions occur. You need to define a system and a surrounding. The system and surrounding, define that. You need to be able to understand how a system and a surroundings can gain or lose energy from each of those two things. What's the first law of thermodynamics? It's described in the law of conservation of energy. What does that mean? Energy can be neither created nor destroyed. So when you've got that two-ton car driving at 70 miles an hour, and you come up to the stop sign after the exit, and you slow that down, that thing down with the brakes, where does all that energy go? Doesn't it just get destroyed? No. Where does all that energy go when you slow down a car? In what? Heat. In the what? Brakes. You slow down aggressively that car. You get outside. You try to touch those discs, the rotors on your brakes. They'll burn you. I mean, it'll be very quick burn. Because all that energy of movement, kinetic energy, was translated to energy of heat by the friction against those pads. Okay, exothermic, that means it's a bond, it's a net release of energy. Endothermic is a net absorption of energy. Can you identify by graphing, is that exothermic or endothermic? Exo, and this is what? Endo, because it gained. Enthalpy. It's the energy difference between reactants and products. If it's released, it's exothermic. The change is negative. Energy absorbed, endothermic energy change is positive. Please be aware of the difference between positive and negative energy release and how it looks like on the chemical equation. Spontaneous and non-spontaneous, what is that? Spontaneous reaction occurs without any external energy input. The extra piece of information is called what? Entropy. How would you define entropy? There you go. Measure of randomness. All right. So this class has been in pretty much high entropy. Pretty random. A lot of other things are low entropy. Pretty much well organized, a crystalline structure. There is no such thing as negative entropy. Entropy of reactions, a positive means entropy will increase, and decrease means a negative means a decrease in order. Which one is favorable? Which one is favorable, an increase in disorder or a decrease in disorder? Increase in disorder is what naturally occurs because sin exists. I'm fully, fully confident in that one of the things that happened when Satan was kicked out of heaven is that our universe that he got kicked into came to have this evil entropy where you can't win. Free energy, of course, is a combination of enthalpy and entropy, and it tells you whether or not a reaction is spontaneous. If it's a negative delta G, the reaction is always what? If it's positive, it's never spontaneous. You won't be able to get it to go. If it's a positive spontaneity there. Let's see here. What did I ask you to know? I think I told you not to worry about this. Yeah. This diagram right here, that's fairly complicated. It really is beyond the scope of this, what I intend for this class. You need to know the idea of calorimetry and calorimeter and experimental change. Heat. Exothermic, endothermic again, the specific heat. You need to know this equation right here. The production, the Q stands for what? Calories. And you get the calories by multiplying the mass times the what? Times the what? Now, if I give you a specific heat other than water, I'll have to tell you what it is. But you guys need to know what water is. What's water? What's the specific heat of water? 1.0 calories per gram degree. That's exactly correct. And it says that right here. And there that is again. Mass of the substance, change in temperature, specific heat, you get calories. Now these calories, of course, well, here you go. Here you've got the change, temperature change, you've got the mass of the solution, you've got the change in temperature, specific heat, and that's the number of calories you're going to get out of it. So you're liable to see that kind of calculation on the test. Okay? There's a high probability you're going to see Q equals MS times delta T times SH. That kind of thing. Let's see here. Bomb calorimeters are used typically to measure the amount of calories in food. A nutritional calorie is actually a large calorie. How many calories are in a large calorie? A kilocalorie. All right? Again, calculating food value, it's the same. Q equals MS delta T SH. SH. Same equation. Kinetics. Thermodynamics will tell you if it occurs. Kinetics will tell you how fast. Thermodynamics, if, that is the delta G. Kinetics, how fast. Also, kinetics can do a, can give you some idea about the mechanism, but that's greater than beyond the scope of our particular discussion here. It's overhead number 25, ladies and gentlemen. Overhead number 25. Oh, that's nice, but it's not crucial. Overhead number 26. The chemical reaction, in order to go have carbon get oxygen on it like this, there must be collision of the molecules. The molecules have to break, and they recombine and reform in lower energy products. An effective collision is one that produces product molecules. Effective collision. Things have to collide if you're going to have a chemical reaction. But do they always collide hard enough? No. That minimum necessary hardness is called what? Activation energy. If you have enough activation energy, you can make an activated complex. That's correct. It's part reactant, part product. It could go either way. Typically goes in the product. So overhead number 28, here's an exothermic reaction. You see the EA, which is the energy of activation. At the peak there of that line, you see something, of that curved line, you see something called an activated complex. That's where you have the structure of material that's both A and B and C and D. It's kind of straddling both worlds, and typically it goes on to produce a C and D. Why is this one an endothermic reaction? Overhead number 29. Why is that an endothermic reaction? Because the final energy is actually at a higher level than the initial. Where did the energy come from to take A and B and take it all the way to C and D? Where did that energy come from? From the surrounding. Surroundings got cooler. So endothermic reactions, you'll sense the reaction that the surroundings, that means you get what? Cooler. All right. So the energy of products is greater than the energy of the reactants. So they got this energy difference from the reactants. Okay, factors that rate reaction rate, effective reaction rate, structure, concentration, this is overhead number 30, temperature, state, physical state, and catalyst. Structure, of course, means that covalent molecules must be broken. Therefore, they react much slower than ions. The shape and size influence the rate. Large molecules react slower. Small ones react faster. Concentration, of course, concentration. The more concentrated, the higher the rate. Because they're going to collide more often. Temperature. Why would the temperature rising increase the rate of the chemical reaction? Because what do? Yeah, they move more quickly and they hit more often and they hit harder. So they're hitting more often and they hit harder when the temperature rises. What's the rule of thumb there, ladies and gentlemen? For every 10 degrees Celsius increase, what's happening to the rate? Doubles. Every 10 degrees, the reaction rate does what? Doubles. Every 10 degrees, the reaction rate does what? Doubles. Every 10 degrees, the reaction rate does what? Doubles. I suppose I'm actually repeating that often enough so that you actually what? Think it's important? Excellent. Good. Physical state. Reactions, solid reactions, react very slowly. They just don't combine very well. Gaseous react much faster than solid, but they're relatively far apart, so reaction rates don't occur very quickly, relatively speaking, relative to the liquid state. Particles are free to move and are in close proximity. So here you see the rates. Liquid is fast, then gas, and finally solid. What does a catalyst do? Lowers the activation energy, both forward the forward reaction and the reverse. So does it change the equilibrium when we add a catalyst? No, it'll reach the equilibrium faster, but it's still the same equilibrium. And of course, we have the mathematical models for the reaction rate. That is, rate is equal to K. I mean, you've just rate times some value here, a proportionate constant. I'm not probably asking you to ask anything about that. Here you have the rate. If N is 1, it's a first order. If it's N is 2, it's a second order. These things have to be experimentally determined. That's the rate equation. We continue on. This is overhead number 39. Overhead number 40 is equilibrium. That's a very important concept. So please know everything on overhead number 40. Also, on overhead number 41, what a reversible reaction is, what dynamic equilibrium is, and you know this pretty well. Overhead number 42, what the double-headed arrow means. You got reactions going both ways. What is the definition of equilibrium? Rate forward equals what? Rate reverse. If you put rate forward over rate reverse, you get a new rate called a KEQ. That's called the equilibrium constant. And so this is overhead number 44. You have a very simple nitrogen plus hydrogen yields ammonia. If you were going to make a KEQ for that, well, whatever. Overhead number 44. There's not much to know on overhead number 44, so you can just sort of glance at it. Over here for number 45, you see where there's a lot of forward reaction, not much reverse, but eventually you'll reach equilibrium where the forward and the reverse are equal. Rates forward and reverse rate reactions are equal. You reach that status quo, that chemical equilibrium. And you can make a new equation called KEQ, and that's products over reactants. I also guarantee you you'll see a simple equation, but it's going to be asking you to make the KEQ from that simple equation. Okay? Practice it if you can, a chemical equation. Then you also notice in the balanced chemical equation, those exponents are the coefficients of that. So if I would go back, you see this P right here? Notice the balanced chemical equation? That P right there would be what value? 2. The N would be what value? 1. And the hydrogen would be what value? 3. From the balanced chemical equation. So that would be 2, 1, and 3. Exactly. So here you see it. 2, 1, or it's just not shown, and then 3. This is all true if the KEQ is at a particular constant temperature. The exponents become the coefficients, or the coefficients become the exponents. Generalized KEQ, products over reactants. What is the KEQ always again? It's what?
Products over reactants.
After the balanced chemical equation, you have C to the C, D to the D, A to the A, and B to the B. And the C, D, A, and B are the coefficients of the balanced chemical reaction. Don't you forget about it. All right. Can you write an equilibrium constant equation? Can you? If I give you a chemical equation, can you write a balanced chemical equation from it? Can you balance it? And then can you write the KEQ? Okay. G6P. Oh, I just want glucose plus ATP yields reversibly glucose 6-phosphate. Just humor me. Just write G6P.
It's the 6, not GG. It's G6P plus ADP. Okay? This is reversible. So the KEQ for this would be products over reactants. This is a 1:1:1, by the way. So the KEQ for this would be simply products over reactants. What are the products? G6P times what? ADP all over what? Yeah, whoops, brackets. Glucose times what? ATP. Products over reactants. If they give you numbers, all you need to do is plug that in. If you get numbers, all you need to do is plug that in. Yes?
So are solids and liquids then not included?
Typically not. These are all aqueous. I don't show all the details, but I mean these are all in aqueous solution. Okay? So that's how they would work. KEQ greater than 100, you've got, it favors the products. KEQ less than 100, less than 1/100th, pardon me, less than 1/100th. Do you have this? Interpreting equilibrium constants? You got this overhead, don't you? Yeah. So typically greater than 100, it means the products predominate. Less than 1/100th, the reactants predominate. Between 100 and 1/100th, they're both basically there in the same concentration. Calculate equilibrium constants. You know how to do that. Plug in this is overhead number 54. You make the KEQ, you plug in the numbers, and bingo, you get a KEQ value. Tell me what about, this is overhead number 55, tell me about the Lachapelier's principle. What is that? System in equilibrium, if it has a stress, what will it do? Shift to relieve the stress. Exactly right. And that's what I'm going to do tonight. Okay, I'm going to just shift. I've got stress, so I'm going to shift myself to bed and then sleep. Right? No, that wouldn't be a wise thing. I've got things to do, people to see. Lachapelier's principle, you've got that. Stressed is disturbed. Caving removing material decreases concentration. You've got to figure out what to do with heat. Heat, heat, heat. So here you've got heat as a product. By the way, that makes this overall reaction what? Endothermic or exothermic? Exo, if it's a product. That's right. If we increase the temperature, which way are we going to shift the equilibrium if we can increase the temperature? To the left. Because the heat can be thought as a temperature product. And so by increasing the heat, we're increasing this amount over here, and it shifts the equilibrium back to the left. And effective heat here, if we add heat here, it's going to shift it to the right. And pressure is only good if they're what? Gases, and the relative number of gas molecules must what? Differ. If they're all gases and the same number of molecules on both sides, guess what happens? Both diddly and squat. Okay, effective catalyst is what? This is overhead number 60. What's the effective catalyst? Does it change the equilibrium? No, it just changes the rate. Okay, changes the rate. Now, let's go ahead and see what we got for overhead number 8. Yes, chapter 8.
For the pressure, if there's only one product or whatever that's a gas, and there's only one.
Well, sometimes it has a different. Sometimes it has a different number of molecules in terms of gas particles. Here you only have one product, but here you see that you've got two gas molecules there. And on the reactant side, you see 1 and 2 with a total of 3.
But if the others weren't gases, only one.
Oh, if the others weren't gases, yeah. This only works accurately if all of the reactants and products are all gases. Yeah. You'll see that on the test. If I ask that question about pressure, they're probably going to be all gases there. And effective pressure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let's go here to chapter 8. Okay, now, overhead number 1, chapter 8. This is the operational definition of acid and base. I need for you to know
that acids taste sour, bases taste bitter. They dissolve some metals, and bases are corrosive. They don't dissolve them, they just wreck them. And the two theories are what? Arrhenius and Brunsted-Lowry. All right, and you need to be able to tell me what the differences are between the two theories. And the base, of course, acid is a hydrogen ion for the Arrhenius. The base is a hydroxid ion. What's the solvent for the Arrhenius? Only water. Exactly correct. Only water. Arrhenius, well, here's that. Here's the problem with ammonia. How do you solve a problem like ammonia? Brunsted-Lowry, acid, of course, is a proton donor. Base is a proton acceptor. That's Brunsted-Lowry, very much broad. You need to be able to identify the acid, the base, and the conjugate acid and conjugate base. And acid, base, and strength. Degree of dissociation, strong acids and strong bases are what? Virtually what? 100% broken apart. That makes them a strong acid and base. You need to memorize this list of strong acids and the strong base. Once you have that listed, you know the general form of all the acids and bases. If it's not strong, just consider it to be weak. Can you identify a conjugate acid and base? I hope so. Conjugate acid, conjugate base, conjugate acid-base pair, acid-base practice. How far do we get today? We got through dissociation of water, autoionization. We got through the hydronium ion. We got through the ion product, Kw, which is 10 to the minus 14. Did we do pH? Now, did I ask you to memorize this? Yes, you'll definitely need to memorize it. I think there are four equations I asked you to memorize. Okay, we're still, this is overhead number 19 on chapter 8. There's nothing there per se. Overhead 20 on chapter 8. You had four equations. You remember what those four equations were? pH equals negative log of hydronium ion concentration. 1 times 10 to the minus 14th equals hydronium ion times hydroxide. And what were the other two? pH plus pOH equals 14. And hydronium ion equals to 10 to the what? Negative pH. Correctamundo. All right, skipping ahead, calculating. This is overhead number 22 and 23, 24. Did we get this far? Oh, okay. I think we'll just stop there on calculating pH from acid molarity, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, and have a great evening. I will have this thing posted.